there are so many people in the field that have a massive heart for what they do, like nurses or techs or counselors or whatever, right? And the ones that have a genuine heart, they do tend to experience that burnout because they have an attachment to how their clients are doing.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most...
You want to pray first, or do we intro and then pray?
Sure, let's pray. God, thank you for right now. Thank you for everyone here. Thank you for life and the ability to just experience it and experience the moment, the present moment. And we surrender this time to your care and control. Amen.
Amen. Welcome to the Most High Show, made by and for people in recovery, a show about recovery, spirituality, and being human. Our mission is to provide impactful, community-driven media that informs, empowers, and inspires positive change. Real people, real stories, real life. This is the Most High Show.
We sound so fancy when Brian reads it.
I know. It sounds so official.
Yeah, that's so broadcaster-ish of me.
That was Brian. He is a guest on the show, and or Mr. Sheets, as I call him, Mr. Holy Sheets. And he's producing as he's a guest. He can't put that chair down and that hat down.
What we're talking about
tonight. Yeah. And we have an in-studio audience. We have Jason and Caleb on the ones and twos. And Leslie usually does quality control, but tonight we're just sending it. No, it is. It is taking over. There's a team. There's three individuals. There's three grown humans who I think can handle it.
Are we okay tonight?
I don't know. We're off to a weird start tonight.
The cadence is unsettling.
Yeah, so it's a beautiful thing. And today we're going to talk about avoiding burnout in the recovery field. Yeah, and not just the recovery field, even for those of us who offer peer support to people or sponsorship or are sponsored. And if you're in that kind of fellowship, you know, those culty people, then, you know, it applies to you too. Because, you know, to love and care for us is difficult. And even when we're kind of doing that on a peer level with somebody, it's still the same thing, caring and loving for an addict. And that's hard. That's why a lot of people end up going into codependency after they've been sober for a long time, because they go crazy. So what I would love to do is just let's let people know who you are, Brian, what you do here, and how you got into the treatment industry.
Great questions. First of all, this is awesome. This is different. I've joined you on the show a few times, but never from like this seat on this table. There's two of us. This is cool. Yeah. It's very different. Used to having a chair and a couch. So,
I almost wanted to change to the couch for today, but yeah. Sarah hey, says I look fat on the couch.
No,
so
Sarah says she looks fat on the couch. Oh, yeah.
So we don't
well,
do
anyway,
couches.
Here we are. Yeah, so here we are. No, it's just I'm looking deeply into your eyes now, so it's different.
I can leave.
No, and it's, I mean, we started weird. Might as well keep going weird. yes, so I'm program manager here at Most High Media. Mm-hmm. I help Christian with some things to get off of his plate so that he can continue to do what he's good at creatively. I think my role here is to make sure everything's going in the right direction, make sure the whole staff is kind of streamlined into one direction. So that is the gist of what I do here. How I got into treatment and recovery is an interesting story. God got me sober October 21st, 2018. I went through a treatment center in Ball Ground, Georgia called Blue Ridge Mountain Recovery Center. I had a job at the time, just a typical stock boy, you know, drunkard job, right? The one that'll hire you for $12 an hour and leave you alone, right? And I kept that job for a while when I got sober, because when I got sober, excuse me, when God got me sober, that was like my whole, it was the center of everything. It was my whole life. I didn't care about anything else to an extent, right? My main primary focus was doing everything recovery. And so after about a year, though, and I'd gone through the steps, written inventory, did the whole thing, made my amends, all that, eventually I had gotten to a space of thinking about, like, what was next, right? Like, you know, should I date again? You know, what should I do with work? Because, you know, I don't want to do this forever. I'm super grateful for the position. And I really am grateful for that job in that company, because they kept me on FMLA while I went through treatment.
Wow, as a stock boy?
Yeah.
Wow.
They were very supportive of me as I went through that process, and being honest with them and what I was struggling with and what I was going through. So that was really cool, and I owe them a lot. but after about a year, I started thinking about, you know, what's next. And I was very much in a space of, like, God, I want you to show me, like, what you want me to do, you know, because I'm always used to my little plans and designs, right? That's my whole life. It's always Brian's little plans and designs and all the things that I want to do and how I want to do it and all that. And I was finally in a space of, like, I want to be led by the Spirit of the universe instead of just me. And right about that time, I was thinking about it. I was praying about it. I got a text from a friend of mine, said, hey, Blue Ridge is hiring for techs. And I was like, cool, I think that'd be awesome. That'd be a lot of fun. You know, I think a lot of times when people have a profound experience in recovery, a profound experience with God or whatever it is, for me, it was like, oh, my God, this is awesome. Everybody should have this. You know, and how do I let everybody know about this? And how do I get in there and, like, spread the good news, right? Uh-huh. And that was my experience, and that's how I got started there. I just sent in an application. It was like, God, if you want me there, I'll be there. I'll just be humble and be honest and authentic about where I'm at and what I want to do. And I started as a PRN tech, which was just an as-needed behavioral health technician at Blue Ridge.
As needed?
As needed.
So, like, what's that mean? Like,
so, like,
the shit's going down.
It's not part-time. It's not full-time. It's literally, they might not need you, so you might not be on the schedule. Now, that was never the case. I worked full-time hours, like, right from the get-go.
Yeah.
But I didn't have full-time benefits yet until that position opened up.
So did you have any kind of formal training?
Nope.
Do you have a college degree?
Nope.
They just were like, yeah, come on.
Yeah.
Like, you're so good at stocking at that store you work at. You should come work.
God works in mysterious ways. Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, no qualifications. On paper, nothing about my resume or about my experience in life other than I was a person in recovery would qualify me for that job.
How long were you in recovery by the point you started working there?
I think by the time I started, 15 months. Yeah, because I started in March. Yeah, 15 months. Okay. Yeah, 16 months, excuse me. Yeah.
So you worked there for a while.
Yeah.
And then you went all the way up to CEO and took over, and now you have a horse. No, that's the different guy. That's a different guy.
Oh, I have a horse. No.
No.
No, different guy. Yeah, that's he was on guy. A couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but you. How long did you stay there before you moved on to? Because you worked at a few places.
Yeah. So I was there for a little over 2 years. Yeah. And I just started, like I said, I was PRN, and then eventually the full-time position opened up, so I moved into full-time tech, and then after about 6 months, I was a lead tech. And then after about 3 to 6 more months, the director of risk and quality assurance position opened, and it was nothing I was, like, I wasn't going for it. I didn't necessarily want to do that job, but I was like, you know, I've kind of, you know, God's given me a good spot here, and I don't want to sound like I'm cocky. Like, I was, like, really good at my job, and I'm done. I don't need to learn anymore, but I was kind of at that place of, like, all right, what's next? You know, which is also something that I do, like, what's next? What's next? So enough people were like, hey, I think you'd be a good fit for that role. Just go ahead and apply. And so I applied, and same thing. I had zero qualifications. I mean, there were people that applied for that job that had master's degrees and, you know, multiple years of experience with that particular role. There was one person in the running for it that had, I think, 2 master's degrees or something like that. Like, I was out of my element, you know. But again, there was something that I heard this guy share one time. He said, if you live by 3 principles, you'd be amazed at how God can work in your life. He's like, if you're rigorously authentic, you surrender the outcome, and you do the uncomfortable work. And I remember when I went into that whole interview process, I had all of that, like, I'm not good enough stuff going on, right? Because I carry that around a lot. And, well, all these people have master's degrees and all this stuff. I don't have any of that. And I remembered going through that, like, I'm just going to be honest. I'm going to be rigorously authentic. The outcome's not mine. It's God's. If he wants me in that role, I got it. If not, I don't. And then I'm going to do the uncomfortable work, which was going through that interview process. Because the way they did that interview was they took every director at that treatment center. They put them in a bigger round table than this. They sat them all down, and then I sat there, and they just peppered me with questions for like an hour.
Nice.
It was one of the most uncomfortable things I've ever gone through in my life. And then I got the job.
Isn't it true? Yeah. With a flashlight on your face.
Yeah, and right. Yeah. Exactly. So it was about 2 years, a little over 2 years. Yeah.
Okay. So you do this quality assurance thing, and then what makes you leave to go, and where do you go from there?
Brain.
Your brain? Yeah.
And that's like the long story short is the way I'm wired. Again, it's like, all right, what's next? But I do remember at that time I was experiencing that role had an office in the business office. So like the way that treatment center set up, all the residents and all the everything that's going on is at the house. It's a huge mansion out in Ball Ground, right? And I had an office in the business office, and I just kind of felt not where I like to be, which is at the heart of things, right? Wow. And Mark Pimsler came in and did some experiential therapy training with us, and the way you train on doing that is you have to actually do it. You have to participate in it. And one of the things that he did was he put down something in the middle of the room, and this is like all the directors, a whole bunch of techs, a whole bunch of nurses are in there doing this training. And he puts down something in the middle. He says, this is the heart of Blue Ridge. And I want y'all to stand where you feel like you are in accordance, you know, with the heart of Blue Ridge.
Oh, dang.
And
I've been to one of his trainings. He's pretty freaking good.
So powerful.
Yeah.
It's so powerful.
He'd be a good guest on this show.
He'd be a great guest.
Yeah.
Let's make that happen.
And we will.
Note for later.
Hopefully. Yeah.
Hey, Brian, send an email. Yeah. That's normally how I remember things.
And so I went up and I stood where I thought that was. I did not intentionally stand farther than everybody else. That just happened to be where I was. And he comes up in his Mark Pimsler way, and he puts his hand on my shoulder, and he's like, man, so I noticed that you're the farthest one away from the center, and, you know, how does that feel?
In front of everybody?
In front of everybody. That's the whole thing, man. You got to, like, participate in, because if you're going to go and run experiential therapy groups, you need to know, like, what it's like on both sides of it. And so he asked me, and I got, like, three words out, and I just started bawling.
Wow.
Yeah, I started crying like
in front of all your coworkers.
Yeah. Dude, I broke down. Uh-huh. He came in and did it twice. Both times I participated in something, I broke down and cried like a baby. I cry a lot, though, in recovery. But I told him. I was like, man, I feel like... like, I miss the heart of it. I miss being in the thick of it with the coworkers and that daily, like, battle of against addiction and against their obstacles and trying to be of service and trying to help and trying to love them and being at the heart of that with the staff and with the clients. And I feel like I'm just in this, like, office just by myself, and I'm not really in the thick of it. And anyways, that was kind of how I was feeling before I – you know, made the decision to leave. And I remember I was sitting in that office, and it was a couple months after that experience. And I was like, God, I was looking on like Indeed or something. And I put it down. I'm like, no, I'm not doing this. I'm not doing the Brian thing. God, if you want me to go somewhere else, like, I'll go somewhere else. And then like 30 minutes later, I got a phone call from somebody at an outpatient center in Woodstock. And it was like, hey, we're looking, we're up and coming. We're growing. We've only been open for like 5 months. And we really need somebody to come in and run the program and be a program manager. What do you say? I'm like, cool. Wow. Thanks. Yeah. And so
does that happen a lot? You pray and then it gets answered like that?
Not as much as I want it to.
That would be too easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Be way too easy.
But sometimes it's in the beginning. It's like that a little bit. Yeah. And then as you stay on the path, it happens less, at least to my experience, you know?
Yeah.
And then I think eventually you kind of realize it's all a cosmic coincidence happening all at once. And there really isn't anything not that God force moving constantly, yeah. Right?
I've had a lot of those moments recently.
I had a friend say, God doesn't have a communication problem. Like, he doesn't have a problem communicating. Like, the universe can, if it wants to get a message across, it's not a problem for the universe. Yeah. The problem is for us to be receiving of it or to be open to it. And sometimes we have our own intentions set that block those kind of calls and taking those calls and taking those opportunities because we have so much of our own attachment to the results of it. Yeah. So we can't let it be what it needs to be or what, I don't say need, but we can't let it be that flow.
Yeah. 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 Well, and I think the prayer and then the, okay, I'm out. Uh-huh. You know, and that's hard for somebody like me to get to that place of like, okay, I'm out. I'll run it into the ground before I'm like, okay, you do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that line in the Big Book that says when we look back, we realize the things that came to us when we placed ourselves in God's hands were far better than anything we could have planned. Mm-hmm. That's such a beautiful line because that came to me. I didn't have to go out and get it. I prayed, came to me.
Yeah.
It's like that confirmation of like, yeah, you wanted to go somewhere else. Like you weren't in alignment staying where you were, but you wanted to make sure that that was true, you know?
Exactly.
I like what you said about I'm not going to do the Brian thing, because I can't tell you how many like shitty shifts I've worked and I'm like, pull up Indeed, be like, well, I'm going to go somewhere where they appreciate me. But then, you know, it never works out. But every like the best jobs I've had have been the ones that I wasn't exactly looking for them. They just kind of been like, hey, I think you would be a good fit with this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sure. Mm. And it's like, change my life.
Here I am. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I painted myself into a corner on this job. And then I looked up and was like, oh shit, now I'm stuck here.
Yeah, you're stuck. I can't go anywhere.
Not for a while, at least. Okay, so the topic is avoiding burnout.
Yeah.
And we're kind of setting the stage
that
you started here.
Yeah.
And then you moved to this IOP, which for people who don't know, what's an IOP?
Intensive outpatient. Well, it's an outpatient treatment center. It offers IOP, intensive outpatient, and it offers PHP, partial hospitalization program. So those are like the way that it goes, you start with detox, then you have residential treatment, and then you have PHP. It's a step down from res, so you don't live there, right? And then you have IOP, and it's all about like how many groups, how many counseling sessions, how many days, how many hours you're in there per week. That's how insurance covers it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But a lot of people will go for something like an IOP if they have a job that they or a family or some situation where they can't go to a long-term inpatient in locked door treatment.
Yeah.
IOP is sometimes a better fit for them because they're still spending 6 to 7 hours in a treatment environment, but after that they're able to go home to their family or go to work or do the things they need to do.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. Or it's a step down. You know, they step down from res and then they do the outpatient and then
yeah.
But either way, yeah.
So you work there as program manager.
Yep, program director.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know a little bit about that, and you set up in that system, I guess, because of how you can accept insurance and the levels to which you're in network or out of network and that kind of stuff, and there's requirements to be able to get to where you're in network and able to do a lot more billing, and I think that was a major process for you that you had to get the whole organization to a level in order to achieve that.
Yes, and you get to see like how God uses your previous experience into your next experience, and that was one of the things risk and quality assurance at Blue Ridge was learning how to do all of that back end stuff for CARF, which is one of the accreditation institutions that treatment centers can achieve the accreditation.
CARF.
Yes, CARF, CARF.
I've definitely done that into a toilet.
Yeah, it's when you...
Yeah, the little morning after stuff.
It's when you cough, throw up, and fart. I think we've all been there.
If you've drank enough, you've probably been in that experience.
If you haven't had that experience, then maybe you don't belong here.
Yeah, no. You're probably not listening to this show.
Yeah, okay, so you get through the CARF.
Yeah, so now I go over to the place in Woodstock, and, you know, they need a little bit of help. They don't have experience in doing all this, so I get to use the experience that God gave me in doing that so that we can get our JCO accreditation. That's the Joint Commission.
And I just realized our show lights aren't on.
Oh, yeah, no, they're not. It's the other lights.
Yeah.
I thought that was on Jason Bailey.
All right. Well, don't do it now because it's going to change the whole lighting on everything.
All right, ADHD. So back to Carf.
Yeah, so...
sorry.
Oh, no, JCO.
Yeah, so JCO.
JCO.
So,
yeah. Wait. JCO. Is it JCO?
Yes, JCO. The Joint Commission.
Oh.
JCO. Oh, joints.
Yes. We're doing great tonight. Yeah. This is fun.
Sorry, Christian, no, you just derailed me with the lights.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Derailed
so
me
joint
too.
Commission.
Yeah, the Joint Commission. Yeah. So putting together that whole, like, streamlining that whole project to get the Outpatient Treatment Center, the accreditation from the Joint Commission, which is a massive negotiation tool when you're negotiating with insurance companies about receiving in-network benefits, right? So there's outpatient, out-of-network benefits, there's in-network benefits. If you've got the JCO stamp or the CARF stamp, it's a good negotiating tool to be able to get in-network with some of these insurance companies because treatment is expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you go through that, and then your time there, and you decide to... I get you. What do you co-own? You buy into? You become a part of a sober living?
Yeah. So you realize along the way in working in recovery, one of the things that leads into burnout is if you're working either at an institution or with people, or just something is not, like you had mentioned before, aligning with your spirit. And I had experienced that enough to where I started having that feeling internally of, like, I don't know that this is where I need to be. And things didn't really work out at that particular place. And I had this spark of inspiration of this whole dream and vision that I have for a recovery center, a center, like literally a center for recovery. Mm-hmm. And all these amazing, I got it all out on the whiteboard. It was named after my uncle who passed away from this disease. And this whole thing, and I set up an LLC, and I got everything rolling. I had conversations with so many people. You know, it's really hard to start at a treatment center, right? So you got to start from the bottom and kind of work up. And so the idea was I was going to start sober living and then just, like, let it flow, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, whoa, that's great, except I don't have any money. I got no money. I have no resources, right? I got the whole company. I got the whole vision. I've got all the bones in place, policies, procedures, literally everything here. But I don't have any resources. And then I got a call from a friend of mine who works at the horse place and said that, hey, you should sit down and meet with this person because they've got the exact same vision that you do, at least like in principle or on paper. And I went and had lunch with him, and he had actually recently gotten sober, but had a very profound experience in treatment and had this vision of things that he wanted to do. So he didn't have the experience. I had the experience. I didn't have the money. He had the money. So we engaged in a business partnership, and we came together. And instead of starting our own, what we did was we got in touch with Debbie Cohen and her partner Arnie, who were running Second Chance Sober Living in Sandy Springs. Powerhouse sober living. I mean, they killed the game for a long, long time. It was one of those places where, like, all the discharge coordinators and counselors in the treatment centers were like, we're only sending you people that we know are, like, they're in a space of willingness or, like, they're ready to roll, because otherwise, you know, they're going to chew you up and spit you out.
Yeah.
60-bed sober living. And so that's what we did. We went ahead and purchased Second Chance from Debbie, and she was just ready to go, I think, because she had, I think, hit that space of burnout too, you know, after doing it for so long. So, So, co-owner. Yeah.
Co-owner.
Yeah.
And now, it's beautiful. It's awesome. And it eventually drives you fucking mad.
Yeah.
Which brings you to the door, darkens the door of Most High one day. And actually, I think I saw a Facebook post.
Yeah.
And
Facebook, LinkedIn, yeah.
Very similar to... The story he's told here is, yeah, I'm following God. I completely quit my job, and I don't know what I'm going to do.
You sure God was telling you that?
So I think we've covered some of the questions here, but I think when we say burnout, what do we mean by burnout? What is that? Because it's one thing to be, you know, doing a hard thing. And having to show up, and then a season of intensity and a season of long hours and a season of time where you're kind of putting in an extra effort. And I think a season of that is appropriate. And so knowing that we just need to see this through and get to the next, you know, whatever that is, right? Benchmark or whatever. So how do you differentiate something like that from what burnout, when we say burnout, what do we mean by that?
That's a great question, because a lot of people think they're experiencing burnout when they're like, they've done a lot of stuff and now they're tired. It's like, no, you've actually just done a lot of stuff and now you're tired, right? Burnout is, if you research it, what it really is chronic exhaustion and fatigue and mental and physical degradation due to prolonged periods of stress. And that is exactly what I had experienced. And I mean, that probably started even before then, right? But that role combined with my character defects and the way brain works definitely contributed to that, along with a lot of external circumstances.
Okay.
So that is like, that was to that question, the difference between like, hey, I've just done a lot of stuff and I'm really tired, or like actual like severe burnout. Completely different thing.
Okay. Yeah, like the difference between, oh, wow, that was a long day, time for rest, versus no matter how much rest I get, I'm not refreshed.
Yes, there's none. Yeah. My central nervous system is on fire and a nap isn't going to handle it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in seminary, they had us read this book by Ram Dass called How Can I Help? Pretty sure I recommended it to you.
Probably.
Not sure you
anything
read
Ram Dass is a Christian Jansen recommendation.
Yeah. And in it, he says, burnout is our intentions coming home to roost. So what he's essentially saying is that the reason why we burn out is because we're too attached to the outcome.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily the thing we're doing or the environment that we're in. It's an internal issue that internally we have connected ourselves to the outcome, and that's what leads to burnout. And if you can hold the sacred space between you and the thing you're doing, or what Dean would say, which is you're not the doer, right? Mm-hmm. And having that separation between those two can keep you from burning out, no matter how tough or complicated or chaotic things get. It's when we have this attachment to the result or what's going to happen. I think anyone who provides care will experience this. Nurses do, doctors, clinicians certainly. Have you experienced burnout in your like in your recovery world and working with others? Have you experienced burnout?
For sure.
Yeah.
I think Sarah's about to say it right now.
Brian said it for me. Yeah.
How do you know when you're like approaching that point?
Well, so I deal with chronic pain, and it's only chronic when I'm under prolonged periods of stress, and that's when it flares, and that's a pretty good indicator. Like sometimes it'll be like a baby flare, and like I had one earlier this month, and I was like, okay, I really need to like reevaluate, readjust, you know, take some things off my plate, make sure I'm scheduling like actual rest. And so I did that, and it didn't work. And so now I'm experiencing another flare of this chronic pain. And so now I'm really having to look at, okay, what all is going on in my schedule? What all do I need to keep and what can I let go? Because obviously it's not working, because my body is physically responding. But before this point, it was like relying on caffeine to get through the day, like, you know, the first cup of coffee in the morning and then the mid-morning coffee and then the afternoon coffee just to get through, for me is a pretty good indication that approaching not a good way.
Yeah. So for you, your body is giving you the signs that something it needs to adjust. Mm-hmm. And I imagine if you keep ignoring those check engine lights and the warnings of your body, that it'll eventually start beginning to affect your mind or your own mental well-being.
For sure. Like that's when I'll start like lashing out, you know, like whether it be like lashing out on myself or taking anger out on other people, like, you know, like not necessarily, you know, belittling someone into the ground, but being like really short with everybody, like just having a short fuse. And you know, like can't be like nothing is satisfactory. Can't be pleased. Like it's just constant negative all the time. Like there's no pulling myself out of that situation. And then like if someone tries to point out like, hey, like you're kind of being a little type of way, you know, then I go on the defensive because I can't hear them because I'm so far. Like I'm just the way I explained it to someone recently was, you know, I'm trying to put out the fire right now and you are trying to install the fire alarm system. It's like, I'm not ready for the fire alarm system. Just give me the fire extinguisher. And
that's good.
Where I've been for a few weeks is just with me and my fire extinguisher against the world.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think like, what made you decide to move from that treatment world? And I know that, you know, it was a big decision for you to kind of not Brian Brain his way through this, but to move into the role here at Most High Ministries.
That's a good question. At the time that I experienced what I was going through that led me to the decision to leave what I was doing, was very much a 1-2-3 experience, like a steps 1-2-3 experience. Like last fall, I remember laying in bed one night and just like, no matter what I did, right? I couldn't take a day off. I couldn't take an hour off. I couldn't pray or meditate or go to an extra meeting or go for a hike or walk more, exercise more. I literally tried everything. Right, every tool in the book, and everything failed, and I had this experience of, it wasn't just the job, right? Like, I was also coming off a failed relationship, and so I had this experience of, like, another failed relationship, and now, like, I'm doing this, and the business is very successful, right? We started with 60 beds, we ended up with 84, you know, we started with, I think, 16 apartments, we added another apartment, we added 3 houses. Like, it was awesome, but internal was not awesome. And I remembered laying in bed going, God, it was the same experience that I had when he got me sober. The same prayer. It's wild when I think about it now, which was like...
Powerless and unmanageability.
Yeah. But the prayer was like, dude, I'll be honest, I still don't know if you're real or if you're there. Or if you even care about this experience that I'm having right now. But I do know at the same time that you can do better with me than what I have done. And so I what I learned through the whole process was like I was still making decisions to be the director, right? I was still making decisions based on the delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of the world by just managing it well. And I still very much carried this idea that my validation is based on achievement. All of my worth is based on the title that I have and all the things. Is my definition of success was extraordinarily flawed. It was programmed, right? But it was very flawed. And it was all the things that I thought that I needed to be okay as a man. So when I had that experience, about the next week after that, it was like I kept in meditation. I kept hearing and seeing and feeling like, it's time to leave. And I'm like, but I co-own this. I can't just leave, right? It's time to leave. And like every day for like 4 or 5 days, it's like, you need to leave. And I'm like, no, like that's crazy. Until eventually it was just so loud and so obvious that I could not ignore it. And I finally made the decision to leave. And now at the time I would have told you that I don't ever want to go back and work in treatment ever again. I'm done with this. I don't want to do it anymore. I'll never do it ever again for a whole lot of reasons. And I can tell you what I really needed was a very long break from it. And so anyways, the opportunity presented itself, right? I think you texted me. You're like, hey, I just saw your post. I don't know if it's kind of coincidence or what, but we got this whole grant thing going on. We got this whole project going on. Let's have lunch, you know? And so that's kind of how it's from a prayer and an experience of failure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the way that we approached it was very unique in that, you know, I was interviewing several applicants and, you know, the way we kind of approached it was like, all right, we're just going to go down the path. We'll do the formal process of an interview and then have you interview with Dean and kind of have you go through the whole process and we'll just see how it shakes out. And so that we were both kind of on this path of like being spirit led or whatever that is, right?
Right, right.
Oh, it's just so weird when someone's like, God told me, like, it's always like, you know, did you take your medicine, bro? Like, you know,
which voice was that?
Yeah. But, and for me, it's a very natural flow and instinctual kind of thing. And I think, I remember after a couple weeks here, sitting with you in this room and saying, you know, I think ultimately the reason why we chose you from other project managers or people who might have been more experienced in the field or in the entertainment industry or whatever, and it came down to, and I think this is what our horse homie said the other week, which is there's a certain demeanor and spirit about you. There's a certain, if it is chaos, you hide it really well, and you have a very calm, you seem to deal with things as they are. And so I think that was the thing that, at least for me, was like, okay, this is the right person to balance my insanity and my creative chaos energy, which is good. We need that here. But we need the balancing portion of that of someone to be able to go. And so, and the other piece of it was, I don't want to be like self-promoting, but I think like this is a ministry. So the way I was thinking is everyone who is a part of this, from everyone who's sitting here to the people who are getting paid to be here to myself, the organism or the organization is serving everyone, including those of us who work for it. And so if you need work-life balance, then this will be a good place, because it took me years of coaching, of a coach getting me to take weekends off. And he started by getting me to take Sundays off. And I started taking Sundays off, which was hard to do. And then I started taking Saturdays off. And now, like, I don't, if I open a computer on the weekends, it's to make music. It's not to work. And so now it's become, I'm really accustomed to being off now, right? But it took a long time. So for me, having gone through that experience myself, it's very important that we have a work-life balance, that you know, work is important, especially when it's meaningful, but it has a way of hooking us.
Yes.
You know, and I think what it's really hooking is the ego, is what it is. It's a sense of like purpose and meaning, and we have to like do this thing, and really, you know, who we are at our core is really the most important piece, not necessarily what we do with who we are.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, like, you could have hired an extraordinarily experienced film producer, program manager, right, to do that job. That would have way more expertise than I would, but they wouldn't understand exactly what you just said. Nor would they, not necessarily not understand that, but they wouldn't understand yet, like, your ethos, what this is all about, and that the primary thing that we're doing here is helping people in recovery. The cool stuff that we get to do is really cool stuff that we get to do. And that's also important.
Yeah.
Because the money that comes in from that enables us to help more people.
Yeah.
But at the core is like, how are we helping people?
Yeah.
What are we doing for people?
I think that was kind of the core of it. As yeah. I felt like there were these really qualified individuals who I just didn't feel could handle some of the conversations that might come up during the day in a room full.
Normies?
I was. Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I could not imagine a normie being.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the right person maybe could have. But yeah, it takes a unique, when you're in an environment of recovery, right? We never know when a time of vulnerability hits or when a conversation can turn into somebody really saying something they needed to have, you know, to say.
Yeah.
And so looking back to like where you got, is there anything that you think you could have done different to avoid getting to that completely burned out space?
That's such a great question, because you want to be able to use your experience and like help other people and carry a solution and all that. And I wanted, like I joked with Joseph, I was like, dude, I wish you were going to stay tonight. And God bless me sharing a story, but like, I wish you were going to stay, because like, I wanted to talk to you, you know what I mean? Because he's about to be in that, well, he is in that position. I think so much of it I had to experience. And a lot of it was a learning thing for me. Like, I learned a lot about myself. Like, there was something that you had said about what Ram Dass said that burnout is that attachment to whatever it is that you're doing. I struggle with that. There are so many people in the field that have a massive heart for what they do, like nurses or techs or counselors or whatever, right? And the ones that have a genuine heart, they do tend to experience that burnout because they have an attachment to how their clients are doing. Like, if you see people that work in treatment, and if they don't have the heart for it, they're cool. They're good. They don't experience burnout, you know, because they've got that. And it was very hard for me to learn healthy detachment, right? Because once I started feeling burnt out, you know, a lot of the symptoms of that are like a disassociation from it, but even to like a negative standpoint of like, it now becomes apathy, mm-hmm. right? And in my experience in working in the field, apathy, I cannot do it. If I don't care, he didn't like that either. If my heart's not in it, I can't do the job. I cannot do that if my heart's not in it. Mm. But there's so much that led into it that was like an uncontrollable, like I don't know how I would have handled the situation differently than what I did. Now, if you want to get me back into that space, I can take what I've learned from it and hopefully come from a healthier perspective. But, you know, when you got your name on something and that's your baby, it's really hard. Like, you carry that weight and you carry the responsibility of it. And then, like, just as a business owner, but then you're talking about, dude, it's a sober living. Like, these people are at the worst, arguably, point of their life, the mm-hmm. lowest point of their life. They're extraordinarily vulnerable. They're in a dark and negative space, most of them. And they're very vulnerable to the worst outcome of what we deal with, right? And so, I mean, I'll just get vulnerable with y'all right now and share with you. I think it was 3 weeks in to running Second Chance. 3 weeks in, it was a Saturday morning, talking about work-life balance. One of the things that got to me was I felt a deep responsibility to the people that were there and a deep responsibility to the name, and I overreached really in that. But it was a nonstop, 7-day-a-week, just, I'm not going to say 24-7, I slept. Like, that's ridiculous. It wasn't like that. And it's not like I worked all of the time, but I was available 7 days a week to a lot of, like, very difficult situations and frankly difficult people, because we are difficult people, especially mm-hmm. when we're getting sober, right? 3 weeks in, I got a phone call on a Saturday morning from our men's program manager, and he said, so-and-so's dead. Mm-hmm. And I was like, say that again? And in my head, like, it took my brain a minute to process what he had told me, and like, I kept thinking, well, like, how and where. Like, he said, so-and-so, his roommate, found him in the shower this morning. He had OD'd. And I'm like, dude, 3 weeks in. And like, starting a new business, just diving into this thing, all the stress that comes with it and wanting to perform well and having all this brain stuff going on about I've got to perform well and I've got, this has to be the best sober living, because it's not the best sober living, then what am I doing and all this, right? And 3 weeks in, I get a phone call that, you know, one of our guys had died. And I'll never forget that feeling, and I'll never forget that experience. And I lived, at the time, I lived 45 minutes away. And after that experience, I no longer live 45 minutes away. I found some place to move a lot quicker, because in my head, I'm like, there's no way, I can't take 45 minutes to drive in there to handle this situation, which is fair, but also ridiculous, because if I lived closer, the guy still would be dead, right? But my brain is like, no, I have to prevent this from happening. You know, it's my fault, right? We didn't do this. I didn't do that. I didn't do this. We didn't do that. Like, it's my fault, right? But just going in there and handling that and knowing that as a leader, you have to show up with strength, right? And not being able to allow myself to feel what I needed to feel just yet about the situation, because I got to walk the program manager through that, the roommate who experienced it and saw it, got to walk shoulder to shoulder with him as he experienced that and the trauma that that was, right? Mm. And then, you know, just watching his body get wheeled out. And this was a guy that I'd only known for 3 weeks, but like I'd already, like I knew him, you know, yeah. And great guy and not the one you'd expect to get that phone call about. Mm. And it messed me up. Like it messed me up in a lot of ways. And I did what we're trained to do. And I talked to God and I talked to my sponsor and I talked to other people in the field that, you know, thank God I've got a lot of connections in the field. And I called the right people that I trust to share that experience with, and they could share their own experience. And like, Brian, dude, that's, you know, with what you're doing, stuff like that can happen. And it's happened here and it's happened there. And anybody that tells you it doesn't happen is just lying or full of crap. And, you know, I couldn't really hear any of that at the time. You know, all I could hear was how I failed and how I shouldn't be doing this and I'm not right. good enough and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Right?
And, you know, then just walking his mom through it, and she was as sweet as can be. And she didn't have to be. She could have blamed us and she could have cursed at us and all that stuff, but she was super kind. And then coordinating with the sister to get the things and with the police and all that. And I'm like, man, this is very real, very real. And that was extraordinarily difficult to deal with. And so it's like, what could I have done differently? I don't know what I could have done differently about that or about really most of the other stuff that we had to deal with. Because along with that is things that just kind of pile on and add up as you go through the process, right? Of just, like I said, it's 7 days a week, it's nonstop, and everybody comes to you with their problems, which is a huge blessing for somebody like me, that God has taken my life and turned me into a man that a lot of people come to for their problems. And at the same time, 7 days a week of people nonstop just calling you about their problems. You know, one of the things that leads to burnout is consistent toxicity, right? Or consistent negativity. Mm-hmm. And it just felt like 7 days a week of negative energy all of the time.
Yeah.
You know, and eventually it just wore me down. I don't know. Other than having had learned from that experience of having some type of healthy detachment from it, caring but also holding a boundary with it, right, that I could have done a whole lot differently. Mm-hmm. It's just hard, and that's okay. Like, dude, that's a hard thing to do. I wish there was more support for sober livings and recovery residences, because it's really, really hard. You know, there's not the margins are super slim. You're trying to help people. You know what I mean? So, yeah. Like, you're not charging.
It's the money maker people think it is.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah, owner sober living. Dude, yeah. I was out to Waffle House after a meeting with the guy who said something like that. He's like, oh, well, just go and owner sober living. I'm like, I wouldn't recommend that. He's like, oh, no, you're making a bunch of money. I'm like, based on what?
That's dope fiend math.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got 7 beds here. Well, how much are you paying? Well, I'm paying this much. Man, they're making $7,000 a month here. Yeah. They don't think about the rent and the insurance and the
rent,
all that stuff.
Insurance, power, water, gas, TV, internet, staff, drug testing cups cost a lot of money, right? Like, there's a lot that goes into it. I wish we could pay for more staff. We need more staff in sober living.
Well, I think that's one of the – Jeff Breedlove was on recently talking about kind of formalizing through GAR a process of certification or licensure in order to run a sober living or a halfway house. I would think that that could be a ancillary benefit to that. By formalizing that process is teaching people how to deal with these things and maybe tools and things. That's also what our educational platform, one of the things that we felt like, you know, we have this educational tool where a lot of sober livings are really good at keeping people with some good boundaries and guardrails up and community and regular drug testing, looking them in the eyes. And those are really great benefits, but not most sober livings can't implement some sort of recovery program. In addition to that, they just don't have the capital to invest in something like that. So this educational tool that we're developing is a free resource that these places can use to you know, add some value to those people. Because like you said, it's like those souls are in this pivotal transformational place. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's only so much you can do. You know, it's like I'm in there running a big book study and we got community groups and they got, you know, we got rounds every day, every night. They're drug testing. They're breathalyzing every single night. We require them to go to meetings every single day. And yet, like, dude, there's, you know, it's not a residential treatment center. It's got overnight techs and people in there all the time with them.
Yeah.
You know, at some point, your staff's got to go to bed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. I would like to share that with my, in the sponsor that I have now, I'm working around a lot of codependency issues. And which was right on time for me to do that. And having people that I'm working with now, and I remember doing coaching certification, and we go through the whole, I mean, it's like an intensive 7-day coaching certification thing, and we get to like the last day, and the teacher's like, oh, I'm really interested to see how you do with coaching with your codependency issues. And I'm like, holy shit, like, I didn't say nothing to this bitch. She knows that I'm codependent. Like, I'm that big of a bright red light of codependency. And when she said that, that was immediately, I had a different person, sponsor I was working with, and he had given me this book, The Codependence Guide to 12 Steps. And it was just sitting on my desk. Because I was like, you know, fuck that book.
Yeah, right.
But after this instructor said that, I was like, okay, I'm ready. I'm going to dive into it. And so I started with that book, which really just kind of shined the light on the patterns and the behaviors. And I would throw the book down, and I would like try not to underline every freaking paragraph. And a lot of it was case studies of individuals who are much like me who had substance use issues and then found themselves 10, 12 years into recovery going, I think I might have this codependency thing, right? And so I did that, and then I got with this new sponsor, and we've been doing a lot of deeper work. And what I've realized is now when I sit with somebody, there is this space between me and them. And what I notice is I'm able to be more honest. I don't have the little filter in my head that's thinking, what should I say? How can I get them to understand? That used to run in my head when I would sit with somebody, no matter in what setting, you know, professionally or just on a fellowship kind of level. And not having that filter guy in there and just being honest and not being mean and maybe being kind of direct sometimes, but not coming from a place of, I don't have any, what you do with it is what you do with it. You know what I mean? Like, and I think that work has really helped me out. I think I feel like when I look at my seminary and what seminary taught us in the seminary that I went to, what was beautiful about that place was they didn't teach us what to think. They taught us how to think. They didn't teach us how to minister. They taught us how to be and how to show up. And you know, you're training interfaith ministers who can be showing up in, you know, crisis situations. You show up in a lot of different, where you might have mixed faiths in one situation. And so the attachment to what somebody's framework or idea of a conscious creator, it could be very different. And so learning in that seminary, I feel like there was like this path that I was being led on. And it feels good. It feels good because I feel like I might actually be doing a lot better now with in my helping of people.
Yeah.
Because I'm not so attached. And not to say I don't care. I do care, but not like...
You can care without being, like, consumed by somebody's problems.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the process for me to get that was reading books, you know, that How Can I Help by Ram Dass, going through trainings, sitting and talking to somebody, deconstructing my own internal hardwiring that was defaulty. Right. And a lot of that was childhood programming. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
I think fellowships like Adult Children of Alcoholics, Codependency Anonymous. I think these are two fellowships that are really helpful for people who don't have a substance use issue, but are in a caring situation. I think these are two places that could be helpful.
Celebrate Recovery.
Celebrate Recovery.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, what are we missing on our amazing outline? Because we kind of like,
we
skateboarded.
Yeah. I don't know. Going on, like, people who are just in recovery, experiencing burnout in their recovery, like, what would you say there might be signs of that happening?
Burnout working in recovery while being in recovery, or
no,
just a person
just
in recovery
person
with
in
recovery?
Yeah. Burning out on their own recovery.
Yeah, and I've been there, done that. And I, you know, and that's okay. You know, it ebbs and it flows. And there's, because there's times and where I have felt that, like, when I start getting into this space of, like, I have to do this, you know, because I'm definitely the type that was wired into, like, I have to do this perfectly and I have to do this really well. And it's like, you're an overachiever or a perfectionist or whatever. And it's like, no, it's still just me thinking that I'm the one doing this, you know? And so it took me a long time to get out of that space, right? And then I've hit walls. I'll call it walls in recovery, where I'm like, I hit that place of, I have to go to the meeting. I have to meet my sponsee. I have to do this. I have to do my nightly review tonight. And I was joking around with Jason last week, and I was like, I'm feeling really rebellious right now, you know? And sometimes I'll get that way with the program. I'll do my nightly every night, and then just one night I'm like, no, screw this, not doing this, you know? Like, that's my way of not burning out with it, is where I'm like, no, like, I'm just not going to do it tonight. Mm-hmm. I even, like, I'm very big on having a home group and having a service commitment in my home group, and I've got that and showing up every night. And last Monday or two Mondays ago, I was like, no, I'm not doing it. Because I don't want to have to do this. Yeah. And I don't want to feel like I have to do this. And when I came out of the space of burnout, of really, it was life, right? It was everything that I was experiencing with relationships, with job, with Brian, right? Is, I think I was talking to you about it, is I had an experience months where I was in that, I have to do this, I have to do this. And then after going back through the steps, taking a healthier perspective and approach to it, getting frustrated with it and rebelling at some point with some of the stuff, where eventually I got to a space where I went back to my home group and I was driving home and I was just crying. I was in tears because it was the first time, it had been the first time in like a year or a year and a half where I was like, man, I love this meeting. Mm. And like, I'm so glad that I'm here and I'm so glad I get to come back. Mm. And so that have to left, right? But looking at that, it's like, definitely know that my experience with that is not unique. And with everything else, with any type of an experience, just having the empathy and knowing that others have gone through that, like, that is not abnormal. We all hit those spaces, right? And that's okay. The key for me is, like, no matter what I do with that, am I going to stay? You know, am I going to make the decision that I am staying, like, I am here? Because that, it comes and goes, right? And it's back for me now. Like, I couldn't wait to be back in the meeting. I couldn't wait to go down to Warner Robins and speak at a 12-step workshop. I couldn't wait to do recovery again. And it felt like this massive weight got lifted. So it's just pushing through that.
Yeah, because I like what you said about, like, the have to, you know, because sometimes you do just have to do it. You know, you don't want to, but it's a discipline, so you have to. But then there's also the aspect of you can't pour from an empty cup.
Yeah.
So it's like, if mixing up the routine is going to fill your cup, then by all means. I heard someone say once that spiritual is anything that feeds my spirit. So sometimes going to a meeting is spiritual. Sometimes calling somebody is spiritual. Sometimes taking a bath is spiritual. It's like whatever the moment calls for.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there's a big difference between I'm going to miss the meeting tonight and then I don't need to go to meetings anymore.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a big difference. At a meeting where somebody, their lead, I'm not even joking, their lead was about how they don't need meetings anymore. And I'm like,
that's their end of meeting.
Back.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, the Lord's never led me to an 8-ball of cocaine and a 40-ounce from the liquor store, you know? Sure would be a cool leading if I was like, well, the Lord told me to do it, guys. I can't.
You listened to the wrong voice.
Again.
Did you take your meds?
Yeah.
Which voice was that?
Yeah.
But it's real.
And it says it on the coin, right? To thine own self be true.
Yeah.
And I think we create a lot of it is like just kind of shit we create in our head, right? Like we have a thinking problem. Like that is well established. The drugs and the alcohol, sure, was a problem, but it was a manifestation of this thinking problem. And we don't know how to navigate our own lives sometimes. And simple things to others is not simple things for us. And we need each other, and we need conversations like what we're having here. Well, and we need to make those phone calls. We need to be in community with other people to help us think, because a lot of times it's us creating. I remember in treatment they had the performance addict, right? And I read this thing about a performance addict, and I'm like, what the hell is this, you know? And it's that there's this addiction to needing to perform, and that I have to have a certain social status, or I have to hit these certain goals in order to. It's one thing to have these things. It's another thing to attach your self-worth and your self-being to the accomplishment of these things, right? Yeah. And I think when I can separate myself from the thing I'm doing, I end up making a better thing anyway. If I'm so attached to it, I'm too caught up in it. You know, and being able to create that separation. But also there's times when I have to, and I think this is the point, like everybody at some level, you have to learn how to self-regulate. Emotional, like sobriety is about emotional and mental regulation. And there are times when I know I need to make a phone call, and sometimes I need to sit and I need to figure this out for myself so that I can face what I need to face. Mm-hmm. And I think it just, like, to your point of, like, it takes time. And as long as you don't get high, you can probably bounce back from any mistake you make.
Yes.
As long as you don't commit a crime and get high. Any other caveats? No, as long as you don't commit a crime and you don't get high, you could probably bounce back from any decision you make.
Yeah.
Right?
As my mom's mentor put it, did anybody die?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and we used to say that at Blue Ridge too. Did the house burn down? No, we're good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think we say after our home group, you know how after meetings they'll say, keep coming back, it works, whatever. The only thing that we say, stay.
Hmm. Oh, you're one of those meetings.
Oh.
But it's great though.
Is that after you play with snakes or before?
You said snakes?
It's while we play. No, but think about it. Like
it's while we play with snakes.
It helps somebody like me, right? Because I'm like,
yeah,
I got to do things perfectly. I got to do things right, or whatever, you know. And it's just, dude, just all you got to do is just stay. Yeah,
just be here.
Yeah,
yeah, I like that.
Yeah,
just be here now.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Which is hard. It's hard. Yeah. The hardest thing in the world is just to be present. Yeah. Which is funny because it's the only time that there is.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, this has been it's been great for me sitting here and talking. I hope it's been great for anyone who's listened, and great for our audience. I think that if you're questioning if whatever you're doing, whatever field or whatever it is, if you're feeling that sense of burnout, that constant, would you say it's like a constant stress and pressure physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, just reach out.
Yes.
And you know, mosthighmedia.org, reach out to us there, call someone you know, call someone you love. Then the reality is, whatever you're facing, you're not alone in facing that. It's very rare that you are going to be encountering an issue as a human that no one else has encountered. So just don't suffer alone, because it doesn't lead to any good outcome.
Amen to that.
Yeah. All right. Thank you to the donors and supporters, and for everybody for hanging out. And this has been an episode of The Most High Show.